This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 385. 385. because I don't know when to quit. It's been a good week. We've got a lot of good stuff done. Some new things. We're moving around how we keep track of our time. And so, you know, there's some new things this week. Got a chance to learn those things. And I'm actually double entering my time now in two different systems. But that's okay. We're going to see how this goes. And if it goes well, then I'll just put me some invoices together each month. And that'll be that. I may use their system actually to do my billing stuff. We'll see how this all works out. But so far, so good. And I've had some good meetings this week. Everything's been puttering along. I just have not had many meetings with friends this week, though. So in that aspect, but as it's turned out, it probably was better. Because I have been writing. Oh, I got to the end of last week and I was still 5,000 words to go, so I plowed through that over the weekend. And then on Sunday, well, plowed through that on Friday and Saturday, and then Sunday plowed through another 3,000 words. So in 3 days, I put down about 8,000 words, and come around Monday, I was pretty well tapped out. It was time to just kind of slow down a little bit and consider, and I had some pieces that weren't quite in play yet, so I had to back up, invent a story about a planet. All of that still is not settled in, but that's okay. It's close enough. All I had to really establish at this point was this is a planet where you don't want to be around the inhabitants. So now that I got that established and I have a beginning on how to get all that together, I can clean that up when I do my major edit before we go to beta, and it will be fine. The challenge I'm facing right now is that I have a little too much story to tell. So some of the things that I thought I was going to do are going to get dropped, which is interesting because it was going to kind of be an important part, potentially, of the story, kind of an emotional part of the story. But now that I'm in it and I may be dropping it, it's okay. There are times in this whole adventure that I'll go, oh, I didn't want to drop that. And then there'll be this little voice that'll say, it's okay. It's all right. It'll come around. You know, so then you just open your hand and you let it go. And it does come around. So it's gonna be interesting to see, because it will introduce some uncertainty for one of the characters as to potentially what happened, because they won't be able to experience what happened. And frankly, I was working pretty hard to get them to the place where they would experience it. I mean, I had to kind of balance some things with gravitational pulls, and I mean, I was working pretty hard to get this thing set up so that they could at least understand what happened. But now that I'm getting to the place where that was going to happen, there's just not enough pages left. I'm really, really close to the end of chapter 28. And so I'm theoretically only have chapter 29 and then 30, and then the epilogue. And I already know what's in 30, and I think I know what's in the epilogue. I hope. that's supposed to be a big emotional thing. I sure hope I've got something I can hinge on there. I think I do. And then there potentially was going to be a chapter after chapter 30, but then I thought, well, I would imagine I could fold that into the epilogue if I'm careful. So I'm going to try to fold that into the epilogue. So I think that'll be okay. Yeah, so this is the interesting part, because I got to land this thing now. But I think I got the pieces. And it's the way it's landing, you know, it's already setting up for the next book, so that's good. And it's setting up well for the next parable, which is Wheat and Tares. And that's good. I did get tickled this week because the young lady who's going to come and stay with us for a while, we were talking on the way in on Monday, and we were talking about the parables and talking about the parable of the wheat and tares. And it's such an interesting parable because Jesus just flat out comes and says exactly what it means, but we don't preach on it because we don't like it. And in fact, when I told her what Jesus said that it means, she looked at me and kind of fretted a little bit. She said, that's a parable? I said, yeah, it's a parable. I said, but we don't like this parable, so we just ignore it. So that's coming up in book 6. But then what's cool about getting started with book 6, which theoretically I will be around October 1st, what's cool about getting started with book 6 is that once I get that done, it's just 7 and 8, which is another year, but it's just 7 and 8, and I've got the first octet done on this thing. 8 books. And I already have a pretty good idea what's happening in book 8. I don't know if it's the entirety of the plot in book 8, but it is kind of everything in these first 8 books has kind of been pointing to it. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff that's been happening, but this has been a thread coming through the first 8 books. I've been planning for it. So that's kind of, you know, fun. It's kind of fun getting close to seeing it coming. But I mean, obviously I've got to write book 6 next, which I got a pretty good handle on that. And it's going to be a little different. And then book 7, I think maybe I've got a handle on what's happening in book 7. And then book 8, I think I know. Anyways, so yeah, so it's fun. We did have the young lady stay with us all weekend. She brought her doggy. That all went fine. Great. It's going to be fine. She's going to be moving in with us in a couple of weeks now. And we're working out the car situation. We think we've got that under control. One of the things that's happening is my mom and dad are selling their car. Well, specifically, my dad is selling it. And he's getting some backwash from my mom because the car is part of her security. She can go somewhere, even though they don't drive anymore. They don't have driver's license. Net and I go take them everywhere they need to be taken. Blah, blah, blah. All that stuff. You know, when you talk it through, it's okay. But when she goes out and she opens the door and sees there's no car out there, not okay. And so she's talking to her husband about that. Now, whenever I go over there and talk to her about it, oh, yeah, no, that's fine. So I was having a conversation with my dad today, and I said, now, Dad, well, once she signs the title, you know, it'll be fine then. I said, no, it won't, Pop. No, it won't, because she can't remember. It's not going to be fine. Do you want to continue to deal with this? Well, yeah, I don't want that car anymore. I don't want the expense. I don't want the car. Okay, Pop. You know, if Mom's not ready to sell the car. No, no, we want to sell the car. Okay. So we'll see how this goes. But, you know, I mean, worst case scenario, we could, we could sell back the car to him. Get that figured out. It's just, it's a very, very interesting time of life. I had something else happen this week, in context of the podcast that I'd never had happen before. I was listening to an old TED Talk and I thought, hey, this is pretty interesting. About why are we happy? Why are we not happy? I think at one point the TED Talk might have been called The Secret of Happiness or something like that. So I'm listening to this podcast and I'm thinking, well, this would be a pretty good topic for a podcast because I could talk about this and I could talk about that. And I kept thinking, I have heard this podcast before. I'm pretty sure I've heard this podcast before. And so then I thought, I wonder if I've done a podcast on this before. Well, I've heard this TED Talk before, I should say. And then I got to wonder, have I done this TED Talk before as a podcast? Thankfully, I name things. I very quickly got into the habit of saying, okay, I talked about this, and this is by so-and-so. So I just went to my podcast and typed in the last name, and boom, there it was. It was podcast 179. That was 4 years ago. I'd already talked about it. So that was the first time that happened, I think. Which it's really good TED Talk. And I was listening to chunks of the podcast, and I brought out some really good things I felt like that fit in my little sphere of my little hammer of how you relate to life. So that's fun. So, you know, little advertisement. If you're interested in the TED Talk, I can't remember what it's called or who the guy is, but it's episode 179. So if you go look at episode 179 of this podcast, it's got the title in there. Ta-da. Okay, so this week, I actually have two different articles, and I came across this article. I think I've mentioned it before, but I don't think I've done a podcast on this one. If I have, I'm just repeating myself. But it's really the second article that I want to talk about. The first article I want to talk about was this idea that has come up recently. There was an article, well, recently, whatever, in the last several months, there was an article in the New York Times called Consciousness, The Mind Messing with the Mind. Okay, and this is, I believe, a quote from the article. The challenge now is to explain how the inner world of consciousness arises from the flesh of the brain. Okay, because this is a problem for materialists. Atheistic materialists, this idea of consciousness, this idea that I feel like I'm in this movie and I'm aware of who I am and I'm looking around and I'm living life right now, not yesterday, not tomorrow, right now. When I was a little kid, there would be times when I'd just be thinking, this is so weird. I'm actually looking out my eyes right now, and so is everyone around me. This is so weird. I'm a little kid, 9 or 10 years old, and I'm like staring at the rear view mirror and thinking, I'm looking at the mirror right now. So consciousness, this idea of consciousness. How do you reconcile this idea of consciousness, of mind, of this feeling that I am not my body, that I am separate from it, that I am using this body, but I and it are not the same? Where does that come from? And so, some materialistic neuroscientists have just gotten so frustrated with this, they've said, well, obviously, it's all just a shell game. It's all just a big illusion. So a neuroscientist at Princeton University suggests that consciousness is a kind of con game the brain plays with itself. The brain is a computer that has evolved to simulate the outside world. Among its internal properties is a simulation of itself, a crude approximation of its own neurological processes. So, he's saying that the brain has evolved to the place where it's smart enough that it can actually simulate the outside world. And in fact, this was the TED Talk that I had come across that reminded me, oh, that's really cool. And that guy in that TED Talk was talking about our experience simulator, that we have this ability to simulate our experiences. One of the things he says that's cute is that Ben and Jerry do not need to whip up a batch of liver and onion ice cream to decide that's a bad idea. You just know, liver and onion ice cream, that's a bad idea. And so we can simulate, and if we think about it hard enough, we can almost taste what liver and onion ice cream would taste like. And we know we don't like it. So the brain has this capability to take all the visual input that it receives. I mean, I'm driving home now, and part of this drive is this winding drive through what used to be hills on both sides, and they cut into the rock. And I can remember that they cut into the rock during this part of the drive, and I can be at home and I can think my way through the entire drive home. Maybe I can't remember exact details on everything because I have other things to do with my neurons, but I can simulate that. So this neuroscientist is saying, well, obviously, since we can do that, we're sophisticated enough that we can even simulate ourselves simulating that. And that's where consciousness comes from. So, in fact, it's all just a shell game. Says the result is an illusion. Instead of neurons and synapses, we sense a ghostly presence, a self inside the head. But it's all just data processing. The machine mistakenly thinks it has magic inside it, Dr. Garziano said, and it calls the magic consciousness. It's not the existence of this inner voice he finds mysterious. Quote, the phenomenon to explain, he says, is why the brain, as a machine, insists that this property is non-physical. Ta-da. Okay, so this really bugs the materialists because it hearkens to something beyond us, beyond the physical world. And this, materialists do not like this. They cannot escape. It's like people who keep trying to tell us, well, free will is an illusion. You don't really have free will. Everything you've done, you are already going to do it. It's not an illusion. It just feels like an illusion. Okay. And yet, they try to convince us that free will is an illusion, as if in their convincing, they might cause us to believe that because we choose to, because we have free will. And like I said the last time when I talked about this, it's like if there is no free will and people are going to believe whatever they believe anyways, and if we are all just monkeys in front of the organ grinder of fate, then what's the point in trying to convince anyone of anything? Because that's what we're going to do anyway. And if you can actually convince someone else, and if your experience can convince someone else, then isn't that an approximation of free will? And since there are so many people in the world and so many inputs and so much chaos as to who gets what input when, doesn't that approximate free will? And therefore, what's the point? So, you know, what's the point of saying there isn't any? Anyways, okay, so I got to close this up because my son-in-law just drove by and we're going to talk about gravel. Gravel is coming tomorrow. Anyways, so the guy who wrote the article, he was talking about reacting to this idea that the brain is playing a con game with himself. And he has a lot of points that he brings out. You know, he says the only con game going on here is the nonsense. Well, the name of the article is Your Deluded Brain Thinks It's Conscious by Michael Ignor. And he doesn't really believe that, but he's just quoting this other. So he says things like, the only con game going on here is the nonsense that consciousness is just an illusion created by the data processing in the brain. Is the brain a computer? Perhaps in a restricted sense, depending on how you define computation. If computation is an algorithmic process by which an input is attached to an output, then some processes are computational. If light strikes the retinal cell, input causes an action potential to be propagated, output, then that falls under the rubric computation. He said, but if we define computation thusly, then any number to ordinary things are computation. Cooking a potato is computation, etc., etc., etc. Yeah, warming, drop here. So the brain is a computer. Is mind a computation? No, it's not. In fact, the mind is the opposite of computation. The hallmark of the mind is that its thoughts are intentional. And every thought is about something other than itself. So he goes on to say that's not the way, you know, computers work, blah, 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 blah. And there's some interesting stuff in here. Well, what is more fascinating to me than all this kind of stuff, and he goes on to make a case. He does make an interesting case that, note that what this means for artificial intelligence. A computer can't be conscious because, I'm backing into my garage, or at least I think I am. I'm pushing the button and nothing's happening. Hey, there it goes. Let's see. A computer can't be conscious because computation is the antithesis of consciousness. Computation is a mechanical process of mapping without reference to the content of the map. Mentation is a mental process of reference to an object to content other than itself. So anyway, so, and there's some interesting stuff in there. You can read the article. It's interesting. But in the process of all this, what's fascinating to me is in the process of all of this, okay? All of this, we're talking. In the process of all of this, where people are just saying, well, it's just the brain. It's just the brain. It's just data processing. You got the brain. You've got billions and billions of neurons. That's how you have consciousness. It's just this weird ghost in the machine. It's like a bug in the process, blah, 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 blah. The brain is just fooling itself, yada, 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 yada. Okay. So you go through all that. Then I come across this other article, and I'm thinking when I'm reading this article, why haven't I heard about this before? What? I mean, I only heard about this in the last 6 or 7 months, and I may have mentioned this. Because it's just so stunning to me that this hasn't been headlines. It's like, what? I actually tried to find out if this is some kind of a hoax. Because I can't imagine that this is known and it wouldn't make headlines. That this guy wouldn't be studied to death. So there's an article called Man Missing Most of His Brain Challenges Everything We Thought We Knew About Consciousness. It's by Ben Taub, T-A-U-B. Here's the deal. Back in 2007, scientists reported that a French man in his mid-40s had walked into a clinic complaining of pain in his leg. Now, as a child, he had this same problem as the result of the ventricles in his brain filling with cerebrospinal fluid. So you got this cerebrospinal fluid in your brain, and there's pathways for it to travel around in the ventricles. They're pretty small, but they can get filled up with cerebrospinal fluid, and of course that's bad because there's not much space in your brain, and so you don't want ventricles filling up because they'll crush the brain. So, the doctors decide to scan his brain again. They scan his brain again, and they are astonished to find, I still don't know if this is a hoax or not,
They are astonished to find that his ventricles had become so swollen with fluid that they'd replaced virtually his entire brain, leaving only a thin cortical layer of neurons. The guy barely has any brains at all. And yet, said the man was not only fully conscious, but lived a rich and unhindered life, working as a civil servant, living with his wife and two kids, blissfully unaware of the gaping hole in his brain. What? Why is this not on the news everywhere? His ability to function without so many of the key brain regions previously considered vital for consciousness raises some major questions about existing theories regarding how the brain works and the mechanisms underlying our awareness. Okay, so if our consciousness is just the result of the brain creating an illusion of consciousness, and most of your brain is gone and you're still conscious, there's something that doesn't quite add up there. So, you know, they said, for example, neuroscientists have often asserted that a brain region called the thalamus, which relays signatory signals, sensory signals to the cerebral cortex, is indispensable for consciousness. This is because research has indicated that damage to the thalamus often causes people to fall into comas, while one team of scientists were even able to manually switch off an epileptic patient's consciousness by electrically stimulating his brain region. This guy apparently doesn't have much of a thalamus left. Similarly, researchers have shown that it's possible to cause people to lose consciousness by using electrodes to manipulate the activity of a brain region called the claustrum, which receives input from a wide variety of brain areas and communicates extensively with the thalamus. Clearly, then, the fact that the man was able to maintain consciousness with nothing but a sliver of cortical neurons reigns all over the theories put forward by many great neuroscientists who have sought the origins of consciousness in the structure of the brain. You know, it may add weight, however, to the arguments made by other researchers who claim that the brain's anatomy is not actually all that vital for consciousness, which instead simply arises via the ways in which neurons communicate with each other. So there's this thing called the radical plasticity theory that suggests that consciousness arises as the result of the brain continually reflecting on itself in order to learn how to become unaware. Okay. He concludes in the second article by saying, undoubtedly, though, there is a whole host of questions still need to be answered, and the majority of theories regarding the nature of consciousness are yet to be fully developed. On the plus side, at least, we know what was making that French guy's leg hurt. So that just, you know, it leads you to wonder if these guys that are making these big claims about, oh, it's just the brain and it's deluding itself into being conscious, you wonder if these guys are aware of the fact that there was a guy back in 2007 that was walking around that the vast majority of his brain was gone and he was still conscious. Because if that's true, maybe there's another source of consciousness. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.